very timely talk on Ruby, Blackboard, and the challenges for open source. And he's also, in fact, I read about Blackboard and merging with WebCT on a special edition of his daily newsletter, OL Online Daily, which is a, I guess, a brief review of a number of articles that are published on the web and elsewhere, mostly on the web, that have to do with technology and education. So he's very well qualified to talk about the repercussions of technology on education and Blackboard and WebCT. Steve.
Hi. Sorry about the delay at the start. Windows has decided that Audacity, my sound recording program, is a virus. And that's typical Windows. And I guess it's only fitting that at a conference like this I have Windows issues. I'm trying to record using this little piece of technology. I don't know if it's recording or not. So if you're listening, it worked. And if you're not listening, I tried. I really did. This talk was titled Ruby, Blackboard, and the Challenge for Open Source. And I wasn't really sure what to do for this talk because I wasn't really sure what kind of group that I would get here. Oh, as an aside, if anybody does have recording capacities and you have your laptop open, go for it. It would be really nice to have a recording of this because I like to get recordings. And if not, well, then don't go for it. I wasn't really sure what to talk about to this group because, you know, I wasn't sure whether you'd be open source. I figured you'd be open source people, but I wasn't positive about that. You know, professors, students, technologists. Usually, I worked as a researcher for the National Research Council. Somehow, I got the job. And in the e-learning research group, which makes me, in a sense, an educational technologist. And when I'm speaking with educators, I go in, I'm a technologist, I fling some XML around, I fling some code around, everything's good. Now, when I go talk to technologists, I'm an educational theorist, and I start talking about Dewey and pedagogy, and it's all good. With this group, I can't really get away with that, because I think I have a bit of both. So, I'm going to be a philosopher. Any philosophers in the room? As Immanuel Kant once said, every time I do one of these talks, any talk like this, I'm always very aware, and if I wasn't aware of the talks we've seen through the day, certainly proven that there are people in the audience who know much, much more about this stuff than I do. So, I think that's a good way to begin with my slides. I do have slides here. I began exploring Ruby a few weeks ago. And Ruby, probably most of you know this, is what I put on the slide, yet another scripting language. It's an object-oriented language. I sort of picture it as though if you took a bunch of Java programmers and they wanted to do something like scripting for the web, you'd end up with Ruby. It's fully object-oriented. It's supposed to be simplified syntax, although it's still got squiggles and colons and ampersands and things like that, so it's not that simplified. So anyhow, I decided, because I wanted to access what was touted as the functionality of Ruby, to install it and try to work with it. In particular, I wanted to work with Ruby on Rails. Because I have a website. I forgot to put my URL on my in my slides, but it's downs.ca. And I have the database backend for it and all of that. And it's a real pain writing the script to do the database inputs, outputs, displays, templates, all of that in such a way that spammers don't show my database and things like that. So I figured Ruby on Rails, that's the way to go. And because Rails, it integrates the database access, it does content checking, it's got its own little fast little server. So I figured, perfect. So I went to start to work on Ruby on Rails. And there's the picture of Ruby. And you can see how it's all framework and it looks really nice. And when it it's working, it really does work like that, where, you know, you've got the browser and it does all the processing, the database backend, and the email management, everything I do. So I went to install Ruby on this. And I went to, I've been at this for a while. So I did my homework. I went to the Ruby website, read what was there, and I went to the Ruby on Rails website, read what was there, and there's links to a bunch of guides, so I read the guides. And the long story, the short version of the long story is, what should have been a 1 minute, well, 15 minute install, turned into 3 weeks. I didn't spend every minute of every day working on this thing, although if you follow that link there, you will find that I documented every minute of my installation process. I haven't counted up the hours, but it actually maps out to something like 24 or whatever straight hours worth of work. Trying to get Ruby on Rails to work on my website. And the sorts of things that I ran into, I followed the instructions, I installed Ruby, 0.8.3 or something like that, and I installed Gems, which is the Ruby installer, and then I installed Rails, and it turns out the version of Rails that I installed was incompatible with the version of Ruby that I installed because the Gems installer was something like two releases behind and all of that. And once I figured that out, and I uninstalled one version of Ruby, reinstalled another version of Ruby, then all of that mess was incompatible with MySQL because MySQL had updated its authentication procedures and Ruby hadn't really caught up to that. And so I'm tearing out my hair, and I haven't put it in the slides here because I'm kind of embarrassed to admit it, but in the middle of this as well, a couple of things happened. The main thing that happened was that my password to the NRC VPN expired. I'm working on my Linux desktop at home, and when the password expired, nothing happens except things stop working. Well, things sort of keep working, but not in the way that you want them to. Also, this is what really kills me. It turns out, it doesn't show up anywhere in the documentation, but when you create a new website with Rails, you do Rails, and you type in the name of it, so Rails to do. And it builds the whole website for you. Then you have to restart the Ruby on Rails server. Well, I tried that. I'm in Linux, I'm in the console, SSH, through the VPN, which is sort of sometimes working, sometimes not working. Kill, and the Rails server is called Server, which I didn't think was a very bright name, but that's what we called it. So kill server, nothing happens. Kill server, nothing happens. A week later, thanks to a commentator, somebody said, well, there's such a thing as kill levels. You type kill minus 9 server. Well, I didn't know this. Oh, yeah. Most of you know more about this stuff than I do. I'm just trying to install Rails on my headset. Now, the kicker is, and this is what kills me about this. Oops. Oh, I did get it working. As you can see, that's the install screen. The kicker is, and I've got lots of comments, because like I say, I documented every minute of this install. Everything I typed, all the error messages, put it on my website, because I'm like that. And so, you take a look at the top quote there. It's pretty tough to mess this up in Windows. And I got a number of messages like that, right? One click install, shoom, it's in. And the sad part is, I believe them. Now, Windows right now is like rejecting Audacity as a virus, but generally it doesn't do stuff like that. Crashes a lot, but it generally doesn't do stuff like that. And even worse, if I had a Macintosh machine, which actually works better, I could have had Rails installed in 2 minutes. So, there was also a lot of stuff, and I'll get to it in a few minutes, a little stuff out there on various Rails discussion boards. The guy's obviously a newbie, right? A non-programmer shouldn't be messing around with this stuff and all of that. But the thing is, I've been using Linux on my desktop at home for the last 2 years. Now, I didn't know about kill minus nine, but I never needed to before, right? You know, kill, what alternate meaning could it have? Apparently, there is one. Kill for sure. So, somebody commented, you know, kill, if you just type kill, it's like kind of gently suggesting that it dies. Like, I've been to fight wars like that. No, never mind. Here, so I think you should start learning more about Linux and tools. Now, it comes down to what your level of expertise is. I'm a researcher from the National Research Council as a technologist. I'm supposed to have some clue as to what I do. It's really embarrassing to stand up here and say, well, I didn't know about kill minus one. But that's the state of things, right? Not everybody's going to know everything. And sometimes what you're going to need to know is a one-button install. And as I commented elsewhere, it wouldn't matter how professional a programmer I was or how experienced with Linux I was, those things that were broken in the install would still have been broken. It just, I would have been able to work around them a bit faster, but they still would have been broken. And the other thing is, I got lots of messages on my board and a bunch of messages on other boards. I'm not the only one to have had this problem. As far as I can tell, dozens of people had this problem. I'm the only one who had this problem and had the tenacity to document every single thing that I typed in and kept working at it for 24 hours and made it run. There's a whole bunch of people out there, I'm sure, who just gave up. That's the preliminary. Because I'm not going to launch into a Linux should be better rant. I know it sounded like it, but but that's the background. Just the background setting. I want to talk about Blackboard now. Now, I saw in one of the earlier talks, a lot of you know Blackboard, or WebCT for that matter, have used it. I imagine the numbers here are the same as the numbers of about 2 hours of the hand thing. Blackboard, as you know, is a commercial learning management system. And as you may or may not know, Blackboard made headlines recently by buying its competition for, what was it, $180 million, pocket change. I mean, this is a $1 billion industry, $180 million. So it's weekend money for these guys. But the thing is, between them, Blackboard and WebCT, now the one big monolith, BlackWeb, has about 3,700 clients. Or another way of putting it is they basically have almost a monopoly over the learning management system market, certainly in North America to a large degree around the world. I mean, you know, one of their clients, for example, is the province of Alberta. I mean, it works like that. So almost all colleges, all universities, certainly the one that we're in now, uses BlackWeb. And the same is true everywhere you go, they use it. Now, because an interesting thing, this just happened like, what was it, a week and a half or so ago. Is there anyone who doesn't know what an LMS is? Yeah. Look, I admit it, I don't know kill minus nine, okay? Okay, a learning management, just in case you don't know, a learning management system, just briefly, is a tool that manages the delivery of courses on the World Wide Web. And in that way, it operates very much like a content management system. Think of it as Drupal for teachers or something like that. And in addition to managing the course content, it also facilitates some interaction like discussion lists and chats that sometimes work. And what instructors really like too is it plugs into the student information system, allows grading and tracking and things like that. So all the academic paperwork can be handled by the learning management system. That's basically what it does. it's a fairly major piece of software. I wouldn't say it's a majorly complex piece of software, but they still do get an awful lot of money for it. I mean, tens, sometimes hundreds of thousands of dollars. Now, And there's what it looks like. It looks like Drupal, really, or Plone or any of these other systems. That's what really gets me about this. Now, what really interested me when the merger happens, these are real comments made by real people, and you see the link there. I'm one of these people who documents everything. So when Blackboard and WebCT merged, I started going, or merged, but when Blackboard swallowed WebCT, I went around the web collecting all the different reactions and blog posts, articles, and all of that about this. And then I put them all together in an article and I posted it. That's one of the things that I did. This, you know, it wasn't uniformly made Blackboard, we had WebCT. It was maybe, I don't know, 19-1. But there were some, but I didn't put those in because I wasn't sure whether there were trolls put in there by the Blackboard people. Anyhow, I still wonder if this is recording or whether there'll be evidence of this later. But really, and it came across in the blogs, it came across in Slashdot, in the article, nobody likes the software. Now, it's interesting because there was the Moodle talk a few hours ago, and people were sort of saying, well, we sort of like it, we sort of don't. Some people like it, some people don't. And quite honestly, you know, it has a very limited function. It delivers educational materials. And if that's what you want, what used to be called a page turner, right? And if that's what you want, a page, and then a page, and then a page, it does the job pretty well. You know, once you get used to the interface and that, you can sort of get around it pretty well. And compared to nothing, which is what most students have the choice between, it's a whole lot better than nothing. Blackboard or nothing, you go with Blackboard because you get something there. But still, I mean, the most hated software on the web, and yet this commercial company has managed basically to grab the market. And you sort of go, how does that happen? Well, Black Web, by the way, is not something that I came up with. Somebody else came up with that, I forget who it was, but they're exactly in that article. So out there in the blogosphere, I never come up with these things. And I'm just drawing here from a talk by Neron earlier today, the talk on Moodle. Blackboard, WebCT merging means more costs, more expenses for institutions. And you look at the alternative and you wonder about the alternative, but really, for all practical purposes and knowing this market pretty well, this isn't going to change. Even as the prices increase, and the prices will increase, this isn't going to change. And you wonder why. Well, maybe you might think there are no open source alternatives. Well, if you've been at the Moodle session, you know that this isn't the case. There are open source alternatives, and there are open source alternatives that are actually better. Moodle, for example, I don't have it in here, but there was a comment on IT Forum came out just a couple of days ago. Someone documenting they switched from eCollege to Moodle. They'll be saving $275,000 a year from now on. So there's certainly a financial incentive to use these open source tools. And Moodle's not the only one. I've listed four of them here, Moodle, Saki, Boddington, and LRM. And they all have user community, and they all perform pretty much the same sort of functionality. Moodle, look at what Moodle is. Easy to install. Now, compared to my installation of Ruby on Rails, my installation of Moodle, which I didn't document, I should have, was a breeze. It took me like 2 minutes to install Moodle. Quite literally 2 minutes. No more than that. And that includes setting up the database for it. Automatic upgrades, which I didn't know about, requires only one database, which I did know about, security throughout, which I didn't care about, and a whole pile of users. I shouldn't say stuff like that, but you have to specialize. And other people specialize in security, and I do what they tell me. that's not completely true either. That's the other bit of scene set. So now we've got two scenes set. Pops are supposed to be linear, but I don't work well in linear stuff. So we've got Ruby on Rails and that. We've got Moodle and Black Web and the whole open source thing and what's happening there. And now I hearken back, it's several hours now, but hearken back to the opening talk that Marcus gave us this morning. Marcus still here? Most of you were here, and you'll recall, repeating it, that open source, the whole concept of open source is not political. There's no open source software, just the software with an open source license. And as it turns out, I didn't know this morning, but I do know it now, one of the major themes that I have in this talk is to assert that that's not the case, that there is something very different going on. And the reason why we need to be aware of that is just to be aware of and to address things like Ruby on Rails or the non-use of Moodle. This is the mental thing that went through my mind as I listened to Marcus talk. And it's like, you picture in your own mind those old gangster movies, right? Or even the superhero movies. And there's always the point in the movie, right, where the hero confronts the gangster. And the gangster is there, and he's always got the gun up. And it's like, we're not so different, you and I. You recognize that one? It's all just software. All the same. We're just trying to make money off of art. It's just a different type of thing. That's the mental picture that went through my brain as I was listening to this tobacco. What we have are two different approaches here. And there are different ways of drawing this characterization between the two of them. I've got a few there, and you can multiply them ad nauseum. Windows versus Linux. Black Web versus Moodle. Recording software that doesn't work versus, well, nothing. PDF, maybe that was a bad choice. Somebody's going to say, well, PDF is an open format. Go for it.
Yeah, well, it's a common mischaracterization to say proprietary equals commercial, free and open source is not. Free and open source can be very much commercial. I mean, Linux is a very big business, as just one example. So it is possible to have a commercial. In fact, free software and open source really is what you can call commercial freeware, because the licenses say you can't, it's not, you know, this is, I think, was Linus's turning point in life when somebody convinced him to use a GPL instead of for non-commercial use. Because it really is a technology that allows you specifically to do this. So it's.
Yeah, but that was Marcus's point. Yeah.
Are you trying to make a comment about quality?
No.
Okay.
Oddly enough, no. I know I've talked about it. Oh, here comes something that. Is it working?
It does work.
Oh, cool.
Sorry, it took so long.
No problem. So even if this didn't work, that didn't work. But does that record more than 30 seconds? That's the Windows sound recorder. Last time I tried it, it records 30 seconds. Or, no? Well, 21 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry. If you're listening to this on here, all of that's unnecessary. My thesis is, and
60 seconds.
60 seconds.
I've got it.
Okay, good. Thank you. I am saying that there is a fundamental difference in the approach taken by open source and what I'll call commercial software. And yes, you can play around the edges. Now you can go into a bookstore and buy Penguin Classics or books that are in the public domain. Therefore, yes, you can buy stuff that's in the public domain. But that doesn't make stuff that's in the public domain automatically commercial. And you can still draw the distinction between stuff that's in the public domain and stuff that is sold commercially. And I'm drawing the distinction that broadly. If we can come back to this, and we should come back to this, if at the end of this talk that distinction still doesn't hold, then I haven't made the point that I'm trying to make. And we can pick it up at that point again. How's that? So that's the philosopher in me. Yeah, you have somebody in the front row says, but no, your distinctions are all wrong. And the philosopher says, well, yeah, but let me make the argument if you disagree with me.
So, are you trying to say that it's not the case that Shakespeare was the equivalent of the great movie makers of today, but in the 15th century, because since the century of the past, Shakespeare's work is now in the public domain.
Yeah.
So that's what it sounds like to me.
Yeah, and that would be, that's not what I'm saying. What Shakespeare is up to,
movie makers of commercial.
What Shakespeare was up to back in the 1600s or whatever, is the same thing that Disney's up to today, right? Write a nice story, put it up in the marquee, try to sell a bunch of tickets, and hang on to those royalties, lock it in the vault if you have to, the famous Disney vault. Of course, in Shakespeare's time, you know, you could use a clock to measure how long it's locked. Today, you need a calendar. No, that's not the point that I'm making. What I'm saying is that what we're doing in open source is something fundamentally different from what Shakespeare was doing and Disney was doing. Let me try to make the argument. If you don't agree with it, that's cool too. I'm used to people not agreeing with me. That's okay. The main point here is to draw out these distinctions to see if they hold. Here's part of the distinction. And the distinction is between different types of distribution models. The commercial way, and you'll probably won't allow that, but that's okay. The commercial way, properly so called, is a broadcast form. We broadcast, you listen. It's the MPAA with motion pictures. You go, you give them $20 for 3 hours of your time versus file sharing networks. It's the New York Times editorial, which if you will, preaches from on high versus Instapundit and the 15 million or so other blogs that are out there opining on the same subject. It's the CD-ROM where the material is prepackaged and everything, a sort of wondering and thinking about that when during the talk on open office, he was talking about the open document format, and it's actually all zipped. And I was thinking, oh no, that's an example for the other side, but then it was too late. Look, these distinctions are a bit rough and ready. I'm fully willing to admit that. So try to draw the rough line between distribution as a package that's presented to you as a fait accompli versus content moving back and forth and around and in and out.
Plato versus Slashdot.
Pardon?
Plato versus Slashdot.
Plato versus Slashdot. Except Plato copied from Socrates. But yeah, Slashdot
takes too long.
Well, Slashdot's kind of a funny case because, like, from my perspective, I don't really write on Slashdot a lot. And Slashdot's sort of, you know, to use the jargon, a web one site where, you know, it broadcasts, but it's not quite because people are very participatory in it.
But okay, yeah. Assuming that you are a student of Plato University versus a participant on Slashdot.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the difference between listening and interacting, in between being, well, in my field, being a student and being a participant in a discussion. A rough and ready discussion. You don't like that, eh?
No, I'm just thinking of your role and my role.
Yeah, I know. I always have that same sort of thing. The thing is, and this is a funny thing, I've tried doing it the other way. I've actually tried coming in and doing a talk like this, and I come into the room and say, okay, we're going to have a discussion now. And we had one guy leave. I do that. I lose about 30 people.
I know. I tried holding workshops.
Yeah.
And it's like this.
It's like this. Yeah.
I mean, I'm the odd one because I'm talking back to you. But
yeah.
Being in your position, instead of being there, I turn the slide off, I sit here, let's discuss. And nothing happens!
Yeah.
You all TV watchers! Turn your TVs off! Arguing with the guy! Tell him he's an asshole! Tell him he's wrong! Tell him he's an incompetent who shouldn't be using Linux if he doesn't know what kill minus 9 is! Come on! Tell him! They're all TV watchers.
Now, and I am the sort of presenter who says, good. You guys want to kill minus 9?
I think you need to kill minus 9
now. You want to kill minus 12, please.
I have no idea. It probably takes your computer and throws it out the window.
No, that's kill minus 64.
Okay. That's part of, okay. This is good. I like, this is, think of the, and the difference between what we're doing is like the new way. Never mind, I've done that. If you don't get it by now, I'll send you an email. Do I have a business map? Did I pass my business slide already?
No.
That all must be nice. My first time using S5s. This is the read silently by yourself part of the presentation. I like to vary up the delivery style. I'm saying I tried that much too. That was kill minus 9. Well, there was a business slide in there.
The last slide. Don't turn back.
I don't know if I can because of that toolbar down here. Oh, yeah, I'll get part of it. There we go.
Your last line, really, if you think that, it sums up a subtext in a great deal of what you did say. Because really, it's about command and control.
It is totally about command. We don't want to lose, I know I made you read that silently, we don't want to lose that subtext. That's another bit of scenario, scene setting. But, let me continue. Where we're at now, we're kind of at this never land, halfway between here and there. But where we're heading is toward what I might loosely characterize as the closed web. Now, I know all of you are working exactly in the upper, most of you probably, are working.
Except for the spies.
Except for the spies. Any spies here? And there's a few ways to characterize this. Again, this list is not exhaustive. These definitions are not like nailed down, but that doesn't really matter. And I noticed this especially working in the field of educational technology or anything. Closed spaces and markets. Think about the sites that you go out to on the World Wide Web right now. Think about, well, Friendster, right? Or think about Orkut, or no, actually no, it's pronounced Orkut. I learned that not too long ago. It's one of these. Well, there's no audio version of these sites. You never know how they're pronounced unless you're like in the know, and that's how you know you're in the know, because you know how to pronounce, correctly pronounce Orkut or Drupal. It was called it Drupal. rolled better. They should have called it Drupal. Now, send a message from Friendster to Orkut. But you can't. Right? You're sitting in Orkut. Sign up somebody in Friendster as your friend. Can't be done. These things are silos. And they're all silos, every last one of them. Site registration. You've all gone through this. How many of you, well, I know you all have, but you've all registered like 8 million times on different sites if you register for sites. Some people don't register for sites. And they're all different. Well, or they're all the same if you get, you know, if you can't remember all your logins. In learning content, in online learning, we have this thing called the Learning Content Management System, or LCMS. And the way this works, again, this is a large software application. You pay a lot of money for it. You install it on your university campus. And the way it's supposed to work is you buy, usually in the form of content packages, digital educational materials from content publishers, and then you bring them in and you stick them in your LCMS. And your LCMS sort of like acts like a digital library for all of your content. And your library is your library. And it's not somebody else's library. So you're not sharing the content that you're in your library with the content that's in, say, Carleton University's library or McGill University's library, much less to somebody out there on the street. But for one thing, digital rights would prevent you from doing it because they don't own or lease this content. Closed media formats. Now, I know, from my perspective, PDF is a closed format. I know it's not a closed format. But I can't read the stuff without an Acrobat reader. To me, that makes it closed. No, that's okay. If you don't like PDF, substitute Microsoft Word document format. But the main point here is the closed formats versus the open formats. The audio formats, Reel or the Windows format, versus MP3. Again, I know the distinctions aren't sharp and crisp. MP3 is a patented format, you have to use pay royalties and all that. Still, draw that contrast in your mind as though it's real. Closed versus open digital rights. A big debate regarding digital rights, especially in the area of online learning, between what used to be called XRML as being pushed and shoved and crammed through the standards body process, so it became MPEG, RHEL, and it's an ISO standard as well, and they're trying to make it an IEEE standard and so on, and it's encumbered with various patents and licenses all owned by Content Guard and the like, versus open digital rights language, which is intended to be a rights expression language that can be used by everyone. The main point here that I'm trying to draw out is that there's a push to close areas of the web as opposed to leaving areas of the web open, whether it be in closed markets for access to material in the format by which you access the material, or in the manner in which you express the rights. And I could go through and I can name another 9 other areas where the closed versus open issue is being debated on the web. I was getting the wrong notes here. We see this very much in the world of online learning resources. And what's happened in the field of online learning is that this whirlwind of standards and standards bodies and acronyms in general has been thrown at us. Learning Object Metadata, which is now an IEEE standard. If you try to find that IEEE standard on the web, you won't find it, because now it's an IEEE standard you have to pay for. The Learning Content Management System, which I've already discussed. IMS has thrown, well, not quite a dozen, but almost a dozen of these other standards at us. Content packaging, simple sequencing, learning design, and so on and so forth. And the way these things work is people who are working for for Microsoft, for Thomson, for very publisher, software publishers, book publishers, along with people from universities and other educational institutions get together, and they say, okay, this is what educational standards are going to look like. And somebody commented earlier, it was in the Moodle session, what's driving these standards, what's pushing them forward in the direction that they're going, is very much found in their origins. And that's where we get the acronyms here, ADL, which stands for Advanced Distributed Learning, and SCORM, Shareable Content Object Reference Model. It used to be called Shareable Courseware Object Reference Model, but then they had to change the part. And what these are standards, basic, well, ADL is an organization, SCORM is a standard, paid for and pushed forward by the U.S. military, in full cooperation, of course, with educational institutes and corporations. And it's not that it's the military, per se, it's that what SCORM embodies is the military way of doing education. And the military way of doing education is somebody plops a big training manual on the desk in front of you, and you read it. And you read it, and you remember it because you're in the military. You have an incentive to do this. If you don't learn this stuff, you'll die. And in the corporate world, it's not quite as bad, but they'll just kill minus nine you and find another job. And of course, IEEE learning object metadata.
There's a corollary there. You mentioned the IEEE, you mentioned ASA, ASA. I've had a couple of levels recently with ASA standards in my own work, which, because you have to pay for it,
sure.
And because they have all this thing about, we're enforcing our copyright, you've got the complete antithesis of what we have of the internet RFCs.
Right, exactly.
Because these are big, serious ISO national standards, it's the complete non-democratization of these standards. It's kind of like the ISO reference model for networking,
sure,
versus TCP/IP. TCP/IP was open, it was extensible, people could comment on it, they could experiment with it, say, well, no, that doesn't work very well, let's try something else.
Right.
And it took a lot to drown out the ISO reference model in North London government departments. And it doesn't look like we can win the battle again in quite a number of places.
Count on it, you can't. And the reason why you can't is because who has the time and who has the money? I mean, again, that's government job, right? I actually sit on some of these Standards Council of Canada ISO committees. And it's interesting because, they're not this great big body of decision makers and people who are experts in the field. The committees are actually just a handful of people representing typically organizations that have an interest in the outcome. As often as not, the standards proposal that comes in is proposed by a particular company that wants to get the standard approved because it has intellectual property in that area. And now, once it's into the mill, there is a tremendous bias in these organizations, both in IEEE and in ISO, in favor of passing the standard. And indeed, once it gets into the mill, it's almost impossible to stop it from coming up the other end. You can vote to approve, and that's just a vote to approve. But if you vote against the standard, you have to do so with comments. And then once the comments are quote-unquote addressed, now you can't really vote to disapprove again. And so you have to let it go through forward. Now, of course, it's always an open question as to whether the comments are addressed. The IEEE Learning Technology Subcommittee Digital Rights Expression Language Group, for example, is considering the XRML, now MPEG, RHEL, etc., being pushed by Content Guard, which is basically a front for Microsoft. And I think Xerox is backed out of it, but it's Microsoft and Thomson, the publishing company. And it goes through, it gets pushed through. And I want, in fact, I did very explicitly vote against that standard in that committee on the ground that the standard requires a payment of royalties to you. There's a royalty encumbrance on it. Out of scope. Not relevant. Not even grounds for stopping it. And so it moves forward. And so I may be expressing it not as clearly as I would like here. I never express things as clearly as I would like. But at every point, there is this push between the closed web and the open web. The closed internet and the open internet. Now, and we've seen this in learning technology. And the way it was supposed to work, I wrote a paper once, 5 years ago, this is like a lifetime ago on the internet, called Learning Objects. And it was a very popular paper and people liked it a lot. And the whole premise of the paper was we could have these reusable digital objects. Now, if we just had some mechanism for creating these reusable digital objects and sharing these digital objects, we could reduce the cost of learning, reduce the cost of learning content or learning materials like textbooks to almost nothing, and we could share them back and forth. So we wouldn't need to produce, you know, 1,000 versions of the Introduction to Mathematics 101 course. We just produce, I mean, not one, that might be, you know, a bit autocratic, but yeah, half a dozen. Half a dozen, you know, gives you lots of choice, and it's a lot cheaper than producing 1,000 different versions of the course. And the web technology, the educational technology community in general picked up on this idea. It's a good idea. And then the standards bodies got a hold of it. And we got the alphabet soup. And, you know, I mean, a lot of you have worked with things like RSS or maybe Dublin Core or whatever. You know, like, you know, 5 fields, 6 fields. Learning object metadata by itself has 87 different fields. And so when you create a learning resource, like, say, a photograph, you fill in your 87 different fields. Well, as it turns out, and Norm Friesen did a study, right, people use like 6 of the fields and they leave the rest blank. And could have left it with Dublin Core or RSS, which is what I've always been recommending. And what has in fact happened, and what has given Blackboard and WebCT the hold that, I guess to say it now, it has on the educational communities, in fact, you couldn't share these. Well, you could. You know, if you're willing to spend, you know, thousands of dollars to migrate your library from one to the other, you could do it. It wasn't in principle impossible, but it was a major thing, a major undertaking to transfer your content from WebCT to Blackboard, or from either of those to Moodle. So now once you were in WebCT when it first came out, very cheap, a couple thousand bucks. Well, when it first came out, it was free, but that didn't last. And it was also written in Perl when it first came out. I didn't last either. And it came out, it was very cheap, $3,000, $5,000, and then the prices went up, and they went up, and then we went up. And what happened was, the reason why things sort of collapsed for WebCT, in my view, is they tried to push it one notch too far. They came up with a thing called WebCT Vista. And if you look at the number of Vista clients out there, well, it's not a handful, it's a couple hundred, but I mean, compared to the thousands of clients for WebCT Campus Edition, which was the earlier, cheaper, no longer going to be supported version, you would think everybody would have migrated to Vista. They didn't do that. So they pushed it too far, they became financially vulnerable, Blackboard pounced. Blackboard had some backing. And so we have these learning resources. A lot of people, mostly, you know, people working in colleges and universities and that, have created are now in this WebCT or Blackboard format, and they're very non-portable. And a lot of institutions have this huge investment in Blackboard WebCT. And so there's this thing preventing a move to something like Moodle or Saki. Probably find it's called Sakai.
It is.
You know, you just got to be in the right in group. How am I doing? There's no clock on this. Yes, there is. Oh, okay. I have no time left. All right. So, okay. Well, I started about 10 minutes late, so I'm not going to go long because I know I stand between you and beer. And so I'm standing between myself and free beer. The very thing that standards were supposed to prevent, says Scott Leslie, is in fact the thing that we got.
Yeah.
Well, and now we move to the next level. Dan Rehat, ADL, all of these guys, because there's more coming. And this is the main point I'm trying to draw out here. There's more of this coming, more of the same coming, and it's going to affect not just my field, but your field.
What really scared me is that I was commenting on at the very, very first session this morning, the difference to reductionism and polism.
Sure.
After the presentation, I was talking to Brian, and they say, the difference between you and me is, I'm a policy analyst, you're a lawyer. And he says, that's no difference. I said, yes it is. You think laws come first. You're a reductionist. I think the community and the community's needs and the expression of that need come first. And it's only when we hit a conflict do we need the laws.
In philosophy, that reductionist position that you're describing is called legal positivism. I just thought I'd get one of those.
We back out of discrimination software.
Right.
We back out of Perl. We back out to the mid-80s. Then you've got units. And you've got people like Rob Pike and Bill Wyatt and a few other people commenting. But what made Unix that great rave that just swept was it had very, very, very simple standards.
Sure.
All its files were text files. Compare that with IBM's system or VAC system, which had 14, 15 different types of file types.
Now, I have to cut you off here because I am over time, and I'm very aware of that. So, and I don't want to lose people,
this,
too many people.
It was this. The standard was plain text.
Anyhow, drawing out, and again, these are the two models again. These are the barriers that are thrown up. I have seen these thrown up in the educational community. You have seen these thrown up in other areas, right? The lockout in the websites, the subscriptions, the passwords, the authentication, the VPN that dies on me when I'm trying to install Ruby on Rails. Proprietary content, as you were just talking about, as opposed to the open plain text approach. What I call high bar, and this is what they threw at us with all the different standards, IMS and all of that, but you also see that elsewhere. You see that even in things like, for example, SOAP and web services, as compared to, for example, the nice simple sort of REST type interfaces or even Arch or whatever. That sort of thing. There's the flooding, which and I haven't really had a chance to talk about this a whole lot, but one of the, and you see it with in the commercial community with things like Starbucks, where the way Starbucks establishes its market is you take a downtown area or something like that, you put like 40 Starbucks stores in a 3-block area, and the stores aren't going to make money, but neither is anyone else, and Starbucks can take the hit. And so you get rid of all the competition, now you can pull back, and then you just manage your monopoly accordingly. The same thing happens in context, and it has been happening in educational context. And of course, something that we're all familiar with is the legal attack. Usually a part of the whole fear, uncertainty, doubt reaction. You know, the threat of lawsuits against Linux. The threat of, you know, again, I see it. You know, if you're using an open source learning management system, you can't be sure that you have proper authorization to use the content that you're using. That sort of thing. We're getting there. This is the key point. Where this is going to hit us, and by us, I'll refer to the open community in general, is at the point of content. This is where the attack is now coming from. And believe me, it's not really a difference, it's, you know, we're all the same. No, there's an attack coming. People don't like it when I say us versus them, but them out there are very much on that wavelength. The point of contact is content. Why is this important? We are moving now into an era on the World Wide Web where it is becoming not just a place where we consume materials, but also a place where we contribute materials. It's becoming the read-write web. And you look up Web 2.0 in Google or whatever, there's a whole lot of stuff about that. It's maybe a meme that's been overhyped. But I think the technological base behind that is sound. That is to say, people are creating as much as they're consuming these days on the web. In a sense, it's always been so, but it's more overtly so now. But what's coming from the other side is what you might call a content clampdown, where the content that you use, and indeed the tools that you use to view this content, clamp down. They prevent you from using that content, reworking it, remixing it, feeding it forward. Indeed, arguably, and I would argue, they prevent you from being a content creator, of getting into that market. Remember before the web, where in order to be a film producer, you had to go to Hollywood and work your way through and like make lots of money and know somebody in the film studios, and now anybody can take a video and record it on the web? Well, the push is to push us back to the Hollywood days and to keep the market for videos to those that are produced by commercial content houses. And you would receive and view the videos, but you being a part of the creative class in this environment, it's not really part of the program. It's like, go to iTunes. There are millions of indie artists out there. How many of you see them? How many of them do you see on iTunes? Yeah, I can't even find artists I like on iTunes because they're on independent labels. Now, the first thing Black Web did after it absorbed WebCT, so it signed a deal with the Copyright Clearance Center. And the idea is that Black Web will now be the primary vehicle for marketing commercial content to educational institutions. And the whole idea, the whole premise, the whole thrust behind this is, it's simple. It's like installing Rails in 2 minutes as opposed to installing Rails in 24 hours. It's that magnitude of difference. I'm not exaggerating. You look at, talk to the people at MIT, Open Courseware Project. Big project, put all of MIT's courses online, make them available for free to the whole world. Great project. The single largest expense in terms of both money and time was clearing the rights to the material. And they only used material they already had rights for. They didn't actually pay royalties for anything. Was just making sure that they had the rights to use this material. And, you know, just to take it one step further, Blackboard to integrate in whatever it means, administrative and academic collaboration products with Microsoft. The content industry and the commercial software industry are creating a mechanism for seamlessly accessing content in such a way that open source software will find it very difficult to match the ease and facility of use. And that is the challenge that's coming. And that is the open web versus the closed web. Open content versus closed content. Marcus was saying this morning, big debate between open content and open source. I'm sitting there, I don't see it. Open content, open source, really is very much about the same thing. And I submit, open source is going to have great difficulties in the years to come without open content. Almost there. Oh, we're so close, we can taste that here. I just threw that in because, well, it's kind of self-evident. A new content regime. And we already see this now. Imagine if your TV does this.
TV will do this. Well, you know, analog broadcasts are ending if you are.
So yeah, I'm zipping through this because I'm way over time now. So, and that's why, and because I sort of have a slow track. Yeah. We have to create what I may style here as a content revolution. This whole evolutionary thing, we go that way, then we're playing the content publisher's game. The content publishers will lead us right down this path to compliance and then lockdown, honestly. And it is going to be as important for open source to develop open content as it will be to develop software. S5, that's what I did this slideshow in, because it's a nice XML format that you can use. I thought S5 was great. And I went to use S5 just to bring things around full circle, and just I wanted a nice authoring tool. Download the authoring tool, install it on my site, and of course, it's in Ruby on Rails. It still doesn't work. I have no idea how to make it work, but it's all there. It's on my site. I have no idea how to make it work. What we need, besides kill switches, there is the open source software ought to be better thing, right? The kill switches should work. The install should work. And a talk, first I heard of it, but Marcel was talking about Qlik. First I heard of Qlik, but seems to me to be something in the right direction. Something that will actually make the install of things like Ruby on Rails or whatever a 15-minute process rather than a 24-hour process. But more to the point in my talk here, what we need is easy, interoperable authoring. I was listening to the presentation on OpenOffice, and I'm sitting there thinking, oh, that's great, but will that work in Blogger? Will that work in S5? Do these things mesh that well? So that, is the stuff that comes out of OpenOffice, or can I access OpenOffice from inside these other tools? Can we get authoring to that level? But not just that. Systems of content exchange and reuse. There's RSS and Atom and all of that stuff out there, the whole content syndication thing. But are those things built into the tools? Because Microsoft's going to do it. Blackboard's going to do it. You're in there, you're writing your course or your document, you right click, up pops a list of commercial for pay content sources that you can click on, insert as a reference, images, whatever. We're not very far from that now. Is there anything like that in open source? Closest I saw was, the clip art thing in OpenOffice. Open clip art. For rights and all that, I won't go into this at any length, but we have a mechanism for making sure that Creative Commons or ODRL licenses are attached to our works automatically as we create them. Is there a mechanism for open identity to not only save us from typing passwords all the time, but to make sure that we're not compelled to become part of an identity federation and therefore into this, again, commercial content closed market solution? Linux has the penguin. I don't know, I just saw it. Why can't open content have the chicken? And there's S5 presents, and I can edit my presentation. That's my talk. I'm really sorry I went over time, but thank you for your patience. I hope I made that distinction, but if I haven't, you can now kill 90. Thank you very much.
There should also be some snacks in here, some pizza or something. Send me five if you have a map.